Let me introduce the four gentlemen who will be participating in our panel today, and also mention that we will have these names typed up for you in the news center, so I won't go through the spellings of them at this time. Starting at my left is Dr. Gordon Goals of the University of Oregon. Next to him is Dr. Edwin Roeder of the U.S. Geological Survey, Dr. Robin Brett of the Manned Spacecraft Center, and Dr. Clifford Frondell of Harvard. And gentlemen, I'd like each of you to give us a brief summation either of the highlights of your own paper or the session, recognizing the fact that we're about halfway through the conference, or perhaps a little more. If you have some general comments on the progress of the meeting to date, you might bring those out also. And since traditionally we've been starting at this end and working that way, we'll do that today, with beginning with Dr. Goals.
You should have told me that when you sat me here. Well, the predominant impression I'm carrying away from the session so far is that we are starting to do science. And let me say clearly what I mean by that. The Apollo 11 meeting and the very hard technical work that led up to it had a little bit of a circus atmosphere in it, of course. I remember well sitting at, I think it was probably this table in this room about a year ago, and the room was jam-packed full of people who were very interested in what we had to say, etc., etc. You gentlemen are the saving remnant, ladies and gentlemen are the saving remnant, presumably, who are really interested in what we have to say here now. And something of the same sort of a change has occurred in the arguments presented, the papers presented at the meeting, the discussions we're having in the halls and the like. We now begin to understand a little bit of the fundamental ground rules. We begin to see something about the basic way the moon has been put together as a planet. And we can construct some fairly fundamental and far-reaching hypotheses on various scales, scales ranging from very large-scaled ones about the origin of the solar system as a whole and the moon within it, to small-scale ones about the origin of particular regolithes that we have sampled, which is one of the things I've been particularly interested in. We can construct hypotheses, state them in fairly definite terms, and think of ways to test them. And that's what I mean by science. This is beginning. Our understanding is deepening. We are beginning to see what it is we should ask, the kinds of questions we should ask, and where to look for answers. And as such, I must admit, I feel very much better about it all than I did last year. I feel that we're beginning to get somewhere, because the degree to which we can understand the history of the moon will help us eventually learn something about our own Earth. And it's very important for us to learn something about our own Earth. We live on the planet. So this is an important, a very important point as a scientific endeavor, an extremely important one. And it behooves us all to make it as good science as we can. That's a kind of a general impression. Maybe the other gentlemen here can reinforce that or object to it or state it in their own terms.
Roder?
Unfortunately, you said just about what I was going to say.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I would like to add, though, that I think one of the interesting aspects of the whole lunar program this time as compared to last time is that there's been far more evidence that the studies of the moon have been useful in understanding Earth rocks. In my own paper, we found and presented in last at the Apollo 11 session, we presented evidence on two different types of phenomena that we saw in the lunar rocks. Both of these have since been found in Earth rocks, and what it amounts to is that studies of the lunar rocks have opened our eyes to what to look for in Earth rocks. We've seen some of these same processes going on in Earth rocks. As a result, we understand more about the Earth rocks as well. This may be a long step from this to making use of this information in any economic pursuit on Earth, but there are ore deposits that have possible relationship to some of these processes that we see in the moon. So I think that this type of spin-off from the lunar program is one additional facet of the entire lunar program that must not be minimized. It is a real thing.
Brett?
I agree with everything the two previous speakers have said. Also, I think that this is true in most fields of science, that as you accumulate data, speculation gets more and more restrained because people are locked into the data that you've got. And so instead of having the whole thing wide open, you have to adhere to the data that have been found out so far. So therefore, I think you've probably been noticing that speculation is much more restrained than the Apollo 11 conference, which was more restrained than before we even went to the moon. And I think this is a sign that we're zeroing in and really getting somewhere. Although it's probably not as interesting to you people, hearing, you know, one wild theory violently disagreeing with another, I think we are converging. Secondly, I think that although it's turning out that the moon is more complicated than at least some people thought, that it appears that we are looking more and more, let me start again, it appears that we do have strong evidence that the moon was hot in its early history, at least partially hot. We do have evidence of crust formation at a very early stage. I'm talking about the so-called creep, norite, anorthosite, and so on. And people think that analogous processes took place on the Earth at a very early stage, you know, that the crust formed early in its history and so on. So I think this reinforces more the old idea of before we went to the moon, that by studying the moon, we can look at the very early processes, we can look at analogs of the early processes that took place on Earth, which are now erased by the geological record because the moon, unlike the Earth, got turned off at a fairly early stage. The Earth has been continuously evolving and hidden many of these early things. I think I had one other point here. Although the moon does have a different composition, it would appear that the composition of the moon is somewhat different to that of the Earth. I think this was brought out by Wasserberg, particularly on the first morning. The other thing is that these anorthosites, so-called, and norites, I hate the use of these terms because they're not strict Earth anorthosites, they're not strict Earth norites, are rocks or analogs again occur on Earth. It's rather strange that almost of all the rock types, the igneous rock types that do occur on Earth, they're possibly the least understood. So again, reinforcing Dr. Roeder's opinion that by studying the moon, we might get a better handle on some of these difficult-to-explain rocks that we find on Earth. That's all I've got on here.
Dr. Frondell?
Well, I think this particular subject is just about exhausted, since you're already quite familiar with it, so I'll endear myself to all of you by saying no comment or no further comment.
I guess with that, we're ready for questions. Art?
Well, to get back to one thing you were saying, Robin, the only thing that bothers me about drawing analogies between the moon and the early history of the Earth is how can you definitely connect the moon with the Earth as far as all these processes being similar?
You don't necessarily have to connect the moon with the Earth. All I'm saying is that processes took place on the moon at an early stage crust formation. We can look at those processes of crust formation, even though the chemistry of the Earth may be different. By understanding what happened with the moon, we may finally, and we haven't got it yet by any means, we haven't even started it, get a better idea of early Earth processes through this study.
Let me elaborate a little bit. First, I'd like to correct one word Robin just used. The composition of the Earth and the Moon may be different, but if the chemistry of the two is different, we are really getting badly fooled. Chemistry refers, just as physics does, to a set of relationships which we believe to be truly universal. And we are seeing those relationships, we think, expressed in bodies of different bulk composition, at least to some degree, with a quite different history. And the fact that they have different histories and different bulk compositions means that they give different end products, which is no great surprise to anyone. But the relationships, the chemistry and physics, should be the same, which means that the mechanisms that we learn about in studying one planet should tell us something about the other one. I'll go even a step further. In doing science, one always is engaging to some extent or another in a comparative activity. You don't do science in a vacuum. You don't study just one entity all by itself. You're always comparing it with something else. Now, in a very real sense, the Earth is all one entity. It's one planet. It shows a great diversity and range of processes. There are many different kinds of geology on its surface, many different kinds of interactions among parts of the Earth, etc. But in a very real sense, it's one planet, something we've perhaps fully realized as a species only upon looking at it from the outside in the Apollo 8 mission. But it's one planet, and it's one particular kind of thing with its own particular history that has locked it along one kind of a path. We need something else to compare it with. We need that very badly. The Moon is not only our nearest neighbor in space, and the nearest planet that we could hope to compare it with, but all reasonable theories of the formation of the Moon suggest that it has something to do with the formation of the Earth, that it isn't just accidental that it's our nearest neighbor in space, but there's some genetic link between the two planets. We certainly wouldn't want to, or we wouldn't hope to learn about the Earth very much, for instance, by studying Neptune, say, for instance. Not that we shouldn't do it if we can, but we can't hope to learn about the Earth very much that way. But we can hope to learn about the Earth by studying the Moon, and to a lesser extent, Venus and Mars, perhaps, because they are very Earth-like. And the more we learn about them, hopefully the more we will understand about our planet, because, after all, the chemistry and physics ought to be the same, even if the composition and history is different.
Evelyn?
Well, please give us a summary of your papers.
The papers we've presented at this meeting. All right. The main object I had in the paper I just presented upstairs a little while ago was to point out, basically two things. One is that in compositional terms, the Apollo 12 samples, considering the whole suite, are much more variable. They differ from one another much more than the Apollo 11 samples did. This presents both a problem for us, it's obviously much harder to understand something like that, and an opportunity, because if we can understand it, then we can learn more about these processes and mechanisms I was just talking about. That, I think, is a fairly statement that just about everyone will agree with, fairly straightforward statement, but one that needs emphasizing, one that needs commenting on. The second point I tried to make was that we can understand in quite a bit of detail, very satisfactory detail, the composition of the Apollo 12 soil. We can make a mixing model in which we put together the Apollo 12 soil from known lunar materials. This mixing model fits all of our abundance data to within about 12% or better. It fits most of it to 5% or better. It must have some reality. Exactly what kind of reality it has, I don't know yet. But it suggests that we can begin to understand in a great deal of detail the histories of this aggregate of fine-grained particles that we're calling the lunar soil. We were unable to do that for Apollo 11. Except now, looking back in retrospect and using what we know about the Apollo 12 samples, we can make a pretty good match for the Apollo 11 samples, too. We've learned something in the interim. So I'm concerned there with a kind of a small-scale problem, a problem of understanding the past history of this fine-grained material and what it tells us about mixing processes and processes that grind up rocks and so on the surface of the Moon.
Well, the paper I presented actually deals with two different subjects. The first one is they're both of small-scale features, but they do have some significance in large-scale interpretations because they tell us something about processes involved. First, when any rock crystallizes from a liquid magma, as we call it, to crystals, during the growth of those crystals, very frequently, little bits of the liquid are trapped in the crystal as inclusions. Just as if you, for example, you took a pail full of salty water and crystallized it, caused it to crystallize by cooling it down, the first crystals that form would not be salty ice. They'd be essentially pure water, pure ice and without any salt. However, in that ice would be little tiny droplets of the fluid which was trapped, namely salty water. And the same thing happens in igneous rocks, in the rocks of the Moon and the Earth. The early crystals that form frequently are somewhat skeletal, and that means that they are feathery like snow crystals, and gradually they get covered over with more solid growth, and in doing so, the interstices are filled with this surrounding liquid. Now, that's a very fortunate situation, because it permits us to, in effect, keep in a crystal bottle a sample of this early liquid. Even though it formed was a liquid back 3 or 4 billion years ago, it has been sitting there in a very good solid crystalline bottle of a mineral like olivine or some other such very hard, solid, impervious mineral. That bottle's been sitting there waiting for us to examine it. And so by studying these silicate melt inclusions in the early crystals, we have been able to get considerable information on the nature of the fluids before the rock even had more than just a few percent crystals in it. That is the one type of work that we've been doing. Both, and I should say that as a result of the lunar studies, we've gone to studying similar inclusions in igneous rocks from the Earth, particularly Hawaii, and have discovered some of the same processes going on in these silicate melt inclusions in the Hawaiian samples. The other part of the work that we presented is a little more esoteric. Is it possible I could use that blackboard?
Yes.
Just a little sketch would help.
Here.
You start out with, say, a pot full of moon magma, liquid silicate rock, and you cool this down, crystals start to form, and these crystals settle out to the bottom to form a layer. Just as in the case of the pot full of salty water, when you cool it down, the crystals that form are essentially ice with no salt. The salt is all concentrated up into the remaining residual liquid. Same thing happens with the silicate melts in the moon. The crystals that form do not have a gross composition the same as the liquid. And so as you get more and more crystals formed and less liquid, this liquid has a composition further and further different from the original entire composition. Now, what we have shown is that in the lunar rocks, when we finally got to about 95% crystals, the remaining liquid became of such a composition, because these crystals were different than the liquid as a whole, the remaining liquid got to such a composition that it could no longer stay as a homogeneous single fluid. It split, just like oil and water, into two liquids. We'll call them A and B. Liquid A is very, very rich in iron. Liquid B is very rich in potassium and silica. And these two immiscible liquids, just like oil and water, separated from each other. It is possible, but not proved, that this liquid B, which has a composition very similar to granite, could, and I underline that word could have concentrated into certain masses on the moon, and so there could be granitic masses on the moon as a result of such processes. We have found one lunar rock in Apollo 12 mission that has a composition, essentially that of liquid B, the 12013 rock that so many people are talking about. And so this is a process of immiscibility, really is the process, in silicate melts, that many, many years ago we thought that such a process explained some earth rocks. But then the evidence seemed to look the other way, and nobody found any clean-cut evidence for immiscibility in earth rocks, and so the hypothesis was completely dropped. Since we found this immiscibility in the lunar rocks, we went back and looked at some earth rocks with eyes opened up to see the features that we had seen on the moon. And sure enough, we found immiscibility in earth rocks. It's a small-scale feature, but still it does occur, and so it is possible that at least some of the granites on Earth and the Moon might have formed by this process. And as such, it is an interesting spin-off from the lunar program to see that we have evidence in rocks that people have been looking at right along but have not looked at in this particular way. No, this is a pyroxenite. This is it's 85% pyroxene in composition.
I should have
one other thing. Any particular element in this liquid at this stage will split into one or the other of these two liquids. For example, if you have some rare earths, they would presumably go in one or the other of these. Titanium, zirconium, all the other elements would split between these two. And this might be important in understanding some of the lunar processes. The splitting is just like, well, when you do some cooking and you have a layer of, say, melted butter on top of a water solution, spaghetti sauce, for example, and you put paprika in. The paprika coloring goes into the oil, and you notice the oil gets brightly orange-red color, but the water solution does not. The same thing is true here. Any particular material will split between these two liquids. Some will go into this one, some will go into that one. And uranium, for example, goes very strongly into the B liquid, the granitic liquid.
Dr. Brett? We'll come back to questions, I think, after each gentleman is finished.
I'm going to be very brief on this because I know the stuff I was talking about tells you more about lunar petrology than you really want to know. The three things that we discussed, which may be of vague interest, is first of all, giving additional evidence that we believe that these rocks are volcanic, that they crystallized on the lunar surface. If you remember, PET, even back in those days on Apollo 11 and 12, stated that they look volcanic on the basis of textures and so on. We had some additional reasons to convince us pretty well that we are looking at volcanic rocks. Secondly, we showed, as a number of, in fact, many other people have shown, that it looks as though these rocks didn't crystallize from the same part, the same melt, and just crystallize at different cooling rates to give different textures and different mineralogy and so on, but that they crystallized from a number of different parts, that there were in the rocks represented at the Apollo 12 site a number of different magmas represented, which then formed the rocks that we see now. Now, whether this is a question of layering, which is probably the most likely, a series of thin volcanic flows coming in fairly sequentially, but and in a fairly restricted time range too, of different composition, or if in addition to this we're sampling a somewhat wider area where flow over here has different composition because it came from a different source, a different vent to the flow here, we can't say. But the conclusion is that we are looking at different magma types. The third conclusion that we had, we spent a lot of time looking at the metallic iron, which you get particularly in the 12 rocks. The 11 rocks showed it combined or very closely associated with troilite, which is an iron sulfide. In the Apollo 12 rocks, you get iron by itself, which is in some cases extremely enriched in nickel, up to 56% nickel we've analyzed in some of this iron metal. And all indications from a number of different approaches suggest to us that this iron was not present in the melt when it was extruded, but the iron crystallized out of the melt during crystallization of the rock. This is also that the melt was becoming more and more reduced as crystallization proceeded. In terrestrial rocks, in terrestrial igneous rocks, you usually get the reverse process, that the rocks become, that the melt becomes more and more oxidizing as crystallization proceeds. And so we have this very different situation on the moon. We can't understand, or at least I don't understand, the ultimate reason of why the lunar rocks are more reduced. At the moment, all we've got to the stage of saying is that reduction was increasing during crystallization. In Earth rocks, of course, it's almost unknown. I think there are three localities in the world where you get metallic iron and basalts. And in each of these three cases, there's a very good reason that the melt, the igneous melt, came in contact with a coal seam or carbonaceous material or something like that, so that you had a blast furnace effect. In the moon, this is not the reason, and it seems to be a universal thing so far with the lunar rocks that you do get this metallic iron. That's what I got.
Dr. Prandell?
I didn't give a paper. I'm a ringer brought in to lend an air of dignified authority to these proceedings. If I had given a paper, I would have given Ed Roeder's paper. I think it was very good. And it had one great consequence, and we shouldn't overlook it. Many people have brought things back from the moon of the nature of rather large and often complicated theories of origin, and they have applied them to Earth's history. Ed brought back something else. He made an observation on lunar material, a factual observation, and then found it here on Earth. And I won't say that this is unique, but it's a very important thing, and I think it foreshadows a number of similar factual observations that we can find here. One of them was the discovery of these two immiscible liquids in the lunar rocks, and then deliberately searching for them in terrestrial rocks and finding them.
If I could say something on that, too. The fact that these rocks are more studied than any other rocks in the history of science means that you, through the detail, things are going to come out which haven't appeared in terrestrial rocks so far. And I think that there are a number of things, such as the zoning behavior in olivines, general mineralogical problems, that people have all of a sudden become aware of. Let's look at this in terrestrial basalts to see if we find it there. And I think that many more things are going to come out of this, again, reinforcing the idea that by studying the moon, we are going to get a much better understanding of the Earth.
Let me make a comment.
That's true.
I think there's an incongruity here, and you should be made very clearly aware of it. It really is incongruous that to find these things which are present in terrestrial rocks, we have to go to the moon. What it means, I think, is that we have been seriously under-investing in studies of our own planet. That's a problem which we should discuss at some length, perhaps, but that is at least my opinion.
Dr. Fondell, are you finished? Or
yes, I'm finished. Thank you.
So let's start right over here and come over to this side.
Yeah, for Dr. Goles, you mentioned that we are now able to understand the mix of the 11 soil from our findings from the 12. Are you talking now about the creep?
No, although I can't exclude that creep glasses are not responsible for Wasserberg's magic component, that some of the isotopic features of the Apollo 11 soil is not a reflection of something like creep glasses. What I can do is I can match the bulk and most of the trace element data, at least the data that we have for Apollo 11 soil, with a mix which consists of the rocks that we find there, the Apollo 11 rocks themselves, and orthosites of the type that have been analyzed by Wakita and Schmidt and were first discussed last year in some detail by Wood, a little bit of chondritic meteorites as discussed by Ed Anders, and a whopping good amount, about 20 or 30% of the soil, of Apollo 12 igneous rocks, one specific type of Apollo 12 igneous rocks. Now, in none of these mixing models do we have any assurance at all that we are making it the way God made it. You know, all we can say is that this is a plausible mixing model. What the existence of such a plausible mixing model does suggest is that perhaps the Apollo 12 site, the rocks at the Apollo 12 site, in some way are more characteristic of Mare rocks in general than the rocks at the Apollo 11 site were, because we see them all over the place at the Apollo 12 site, and we have evidence that they constitute a significant fraction of the soil at the Apollo 11 site. The Apollo 11 rocks, in many respects, are rather unusual beasties, and this just reinforces the feeling that they are maybe so unusual that they are not really characteristic in any sense of the word.
So I think we had John Lannan and then right up here.
This is a lousy question for a panel of scientists, but can you tell us in more specific terms what this new look at terrestrial geology is going to mean, other than the understanding of what has happened in the past? We're all interested in that from a nice esoteric point of view, but this is the age of relevance, and readers like to know what it really means to them tomorrow, in terms of understanding what happened on Earth here yesterday. Would somebody like to address themselves? That Dr. Roeder is...
I'd like to say a word about that. As I pointed out, in my own work helps to understand some of the processes that have gone on Earth, and even some in the formation of some ore deposits. The relevance of any understanding of Earth processes, even though we're dealing with understanding processes that have long since discontinued, we're dealing with understanding the past, is that if nothing else, in the future, we need mineral resources. And we're going to get mineral resources by finding ore deposits. We find ore deposits, essentially, not by just looking for them, but by knowing how they got to be, how they occurred, why they are where they are. Once we know these particular features, we can be much better in prospecting for ore deposits. And so the more we understand about geological processes, the better we know where to go to look for ore.
Right here.
Yes, Dr. Roeder, that B-type liquid is equivalent in rock 13 to the white part?
The white part, yes. And it is high in, most of the uranium is concentrated there, for example, and as a result, and also most of the potassium. It has maybe 20 times as much potassium as the A-type. And so the people that are doing age determination work, for example, they are working mainly, if they're working in, say, potassium-argon determinations, they're working mainly with the potassium that is in that B-type rock. It will be as minor little bits of B-type material scattered all through the rock. It doesn't all come up to the top like that. It's little blebs scattered through the mush of crystals. But still, most of the argon and potassium is in that B-type material.
Can I ask a second question along the same line? The B-type material in the Rock 13 was liquid at a far later date than the dark material. Is that?
We don't know far later. Maybe just a slight bit later. The temperatures of crystallization of these two would be different. You would expect B to stay liquid longer than the A.
Mark Bloom.
Dr. Frondell, if someone were to give you tomorrow an ounce or so of the Sea of Fertility, what do you think would be reasonable to expect to find there in relation to the other two Mare sites we've explored?
Well, the Russians are facing that problem in a very practical way at the moment. As you know, they have, what is it, it's just about an ounce. I'd send a man up there and bring back a lot of it. I mean, that really is the answer to the question. When you have such a small sample, you are denied the opportunity to make a complete or a general study of it. And the information that would be derived from it would be of necessity, and by that I mean by characters inherent in the size, to particular topics of investigation. What really is needed is a fairly large size reconnaissance of the site, so that you can put the sample into context. And I would, of course, enlarged on that to show the inadequacy of a small sample taken out of context and taken without the intervention or the operation of the human mind and eyes.
I'd like to suggest what would have happened during the Apollo 11 mission. They'd only been able to get 1 ounce, and it happened to have been 12013.
It would have been one.
It would have been an awful mess.
On the other hand, I'd like to say that all this business of finding creep, which has been found by a number of different groups, these groups, most of them got no more than a gram of coarse fines. Yes, I agree with Dr. Frondell enormously that it's nice to have as big a sample as you can, but boy, you can get a hell of a lot of information out of a small amount of material. And I think that the Russians will do this. And you saw the basalts in the coarse fines, you saw the creep in the coarse fines, you didn't have the relevance as far as where it came from and so on. But it's a great deal better, an enormous amount better than having nothing at all.
Yeah. Let's go back even further. If we had gotten 1 ounce of regolith from Apollo 11, let's say, it's true, I'm sure that we would have seen that there were basalt fragments in it and that there were probably we would have seen fragments of anorthosites. But what would the dating people have done? They would have dated it, and they would have found the model age of 4.44 or 4.5 billion years, something like that, and they would have said, gee, that's just what we want. The moon is a primary object, you know? Yeah. And it would have been years before anybody would have been smart enough to figure out that there's something a little bit wrong with that model age. Whereas, as it is, when we're faced with both the rocks and the soil, and we can see that there's something wrong, we have to face the problem.
True. All I'm saying is that you can get a lot of information out of a small sample.
But sometimes it's misleading information.
Oh, yeah.
And for all we know, we are still dealing with misleading information.
Hey, Zach Strickland.
Last year, if one thing fell out of the science conferences was that the returns from Apollo 11 were unearthly, to say the least. Now, based on what Dr. Roeder's found, is it possible that the rocks on Earth are really not so unlike those on the moon after all? That maybe somebody should contemplate his navel a little more?
Well, maybe I could. I'd like to make one comment here, and that is that there are chemical differences, for example, the titanium, but most important difference between Earth and moon that I would say is the chemical difference in the lack of water. The presence of water on Earth has made a tremendous difference. And so, if nothing else, it has caused confusion in covering up the tracks of some of the processes, such as I've been talking about on here. They're difficult to find in Earth rocks because the presence of water has revised the mineralogy and made it difficult to see.
Yeah, this is, in a way, the distinction I was speaking of between fundamental mechanism and the accidents of history and composition. The moon and the Earth really are different. The composition is different. The history is very obviously different. The Earth churns. It turns itself inside out, so to speak, and it wipes out the old history. And that makes life very difficult for geologists, to say the least. The moon doesn't do this. But the mechanisms, the basic principles are the same. That's what we're learning about.
Right here, and then John Lennon.
In the light of the moon helping us to understand the Earth better, if the present Apollo program should be abbreviated or otherwise abort on...
Shall further be.
Yes. Do we have enough materials from the moon now that we can finally put all the pieces together and have the total picture?
Unequivocally, without any question, no. If we were to restore all the chopped-off missions, the answer would still be no. If we put 20 more missions on the surface, the answer would still be no. We are faced with the problem of exploring a surface on an entirely unknown planet which has a surface area approximately that of the continent of Africa. Now, you imagine what kind of response you would get if you told a team of geologists that they could put a few of their members down on the continent of Africa, that they could fly over it and observe some of its landforms, that they could only sample it in maybe 10, 15, 20 places. They would kick you in the shins. And this is a very appropriate response. One of our major problems with understanding the moon is just sampling. We just don't know to what extent we're getting fooled by local inhomogeneities. As I just mentioned before, it looks now as if in some ways Apollo 11 was a very unusual mare site. And for all we know, Apollo 12 is very unusual too, and 14 will land in some... It's picked to be an unusual area, etc., etc., etc. In a sense, we have no other choice. We have to pick the things that look interesting, and the things that look interesting are almost certain to be unusual.
John?
We've heard for the past couple of days about different chemistry, but basically the same starting materials, the same elements. Would anyone here be prepared to go so far as to say that it was water that made the crucial difference in the gross differences that we see between the terrestrial and the lunar materials?
I think it was water that made a part of the difference, but I think the gross difference is in the size of the planet. The moon is a small enough planet so that unless you introduce inside it some really remarkable heat source, you cannot get it to churn the way the Earth is churning. Now, the Earth's churning, the seafloor spreading and the continental drift that we've heard so much about, and which is a very exciting change, modification of our ideas in geology, is almost certainly related, at least in part, to the presence of water in the upper mantle of the Earth as a kind of a way of getting part of it to melt and provide a lubricant. But the Earth is a big planet, a big heat engine, and it would in one sense or another churn even if it were fairly dry. The moon cannot. I think the major difference may well be the size of the planet.
Dr. Roeder, I want to get a little bit clearer about your immiscibility. Was this known to be possible, or is this a phenomenon that was discovered only through examination of the moon rocks?
No. The process of immiscibility has long been known. For example, all smelting operations work on the basis of immiscible metal and silicate slag. Those are immiscible liquids there. But in the case of the immiscibility we're talking about here, it's between two silicate slags, and in effect two slags that are immiscible. Now, we have known for many years that such immiscibility occurs in the laboratory. We've done it, but at much higher temperatures and under very much more unusual compositions than any ordinary earth rocks. Nobody has ever taken material such as we now find A and B there and tried to make try to melt them together and have obtained an immiscible melt. As a result of this operation, now finding these things on the moon, I made up synthetic mixtures of pseudo moon rocks or synthesized moon rocks of A and B in half and half A and B, melted it at high temperatures to a completely homogeneous fluid, and then cooled it down, and it did split. In other words, we have duplicated in the laboratory. We had such immiscibility before, but under much more limited conditions. For example, just iron and silica will form immiscible silicate. Iron oxide and silica oxide will form immiscible silicate melts. But if you add a little bit of other constituents, you normally eliminate that immiscibility. In this case, the other constituents have not eliminated it. It's a very special situation. If we added some other constituents to the moon rocks in maybe only a few percent, we might eliminate that immiscibility. So this is the sort of thing that has to be tested in the laboratory. But we did know of such immiscibility, but not these particular compositions. No, this is just liquids. There are no crystals here at all we're talking about. This is equilibrium between liquids. Just like oil and water will stay immiscible. You take a bottle of salad oil and water, oil and vinegar, and you shake it up. You have globules of one and the other in one. They'll gradually settle out, and you have two layers. No matter how long you let that sit, it'll always be two layers. Same thing is true here.
Zach.
Dr. Brett, I believe you and nine colleagues have applied for a patent on a process to extract water from lunar material. Yesterday we were told that the moon is perhaps a million times drier than, the Gobi Desert. Have you learned anything here that would have you go back to MSC and revise your patent process?
Not at all. This patent is so simple-minded that it embarrassed us, the publicity it got. I mean, any person who works in the phase equilibria business, in other words, trying to synthesize rocks, if he's working with metal, iron, he knows that he has to reduce this iron so that there's no iron oxide present. And what you do is you pass hydrogen over that iron at high temperature, and, of course, the oxide reacts with the hydrogen to form water, and you're left with pure iron. We thought, okay, fine, you just do the reverse. You take some hydrogen from Earth, heat it up with the lunar soil, which is rich in ilmenite, which contains iron oxide, which is readily reduced at temperatures from about 600 degrees on. You get the water off. If you want the water, you drink it. You can electrolyze the astronaut's urine, if you like, to recycle your hydrogen. If you want oxygen, you electrolyze the water right away and you get the hydrogen off, which you can recycle again. There's no water per se in the moon rocks themselves. We're just using hydrogen to get oxygen to combine to make water. That's all. The attorneys, this whole thing, I mean, even the idea of patenting it, we found very strange. It must be one of the most bizarre patents in history. The lawyers assured us and encouraged us to patent the idea.
I think we had a question from Mark Bloom.
Dr. Frondell, sorry to go back to this, but did I understand from what you said that almost by necessity, because of the size of the Luna 16 sample, anything the Russians report will be scientifically more suspect that?
I did not mean to imply that. What they can report by virtue of this sample size is as good as anybody else is going to be, can find. Their scientists are like our scientists. Their equipment is like our equipment. Their curiosity and their initiative and work habits will yield the information that is within their sample. But it's a small package. It just doesn't carry the amount of information that a man-collected, large-sized sample made in light of the context of the sample, the geological surroundings and the like, would yield. That was my point. None of us would, the Russian scientists are damn good. We have the large and belligerent one on the premises at the moment, so take this easy.
That wasn't exactly what I meant. What I meant was that, or maybe it was Dr. Goles who indicated that that from the Luna 16 information, we're more likely to be fooled about what sea of fertility is than we were from Apollo 11.
Well, in the sense that Cliff mentioned, a smaller size sample carries less information, and with less information, it's always easy to be fooled. I would like to disagree with one thing he said, and this might lead into an interesting exchange, and that is, I don't think it is necessary for a large sample to be a man-collected sample. I think that a properly instrumented unmanned probe, which has facilities for returning large amounts of sample from well-documented locations, would, if cheaper than the equivalent in a manned probe situation, be preferable. Because, as I mentioned before, we have a severe sampling problem here. If we assume we have only so many dollars to cut out of the national pie, we had better use those dollars in the most efficient way possible. And I am not personally convinced that the most efficient way possible is to put men on the moon so they can walk around. I do feel very strongly that we need to return large samples to Earth. They need to be carefully selected samples and carefully documented samples. And if the best way to do that is to put men there, fine. If there's some other way of doing it, we should be thinking about some other way of doing it. But we desperately need many samples.
Paul Razor.
Their sample.
Dr. Goles, that's kind of interesting. A lot of what you said earlier. You said that the most important sample would be one that is different, but because it's more, it'll tell you more. It's more interesting. Do you think a machine can be designed to tell which rock is interesting, which rock is not, and pick out the interesting?
My dear sir, the astronauts don't pick out the interesting rocks. And in fact, even if Jack Schmidt ever does get on that surface, which I devoutly hope he does, he will see some interesting relationships, but it is not likely that with the dust that covers the rocks, he'll be able to pick out the interesting rocks.
No, I disagree strongly,
Gordon. Okay, let's have a fight about it.
First of all, further pursuit of this package of dirty linen will only yield something newsworthy. So what I say is, watch your step.
All I'm doing, I'm not going to make any more dirty linen. I'm going to show you that some of the linen which Cliff thinks is dirty is not really dirty at all, namely the rocks. If you look at the photographs outside there, the stereo things, you'll see that the rocks are not covered by dust at all. You can see many relationships with the rocks, the fresh surfaces, no dust whatsoever.
And you're alleging that a television camera could not see those
relationships? No, we're talking about astronauts picking up rocks and being able to
And I was alleging that the astronauts that we had on the surface did not make a very successful conscious attempt to pick up interesting rocks. Now, you may argue with me on that, but I want to make the point that a television camera directing a scoop to put something into a package to be sent back here, which is, in turn, the television camera and the whole equipment directed by intelligent geologists sitting here on Earth, would be a good way to do things.
This would be a way to do it. I was just correcting in the fact that it is possible to see rocks on the moon which are different, they're not covered by dust, and an intelligent man can go and pick up this rock because it looks different to that one. So
maybe you want to argue that geologic training is not necessary in this choice, which I personally would think to be a peculiar argument coming from you, but I'm willing to have that argument.
I just wanted to make a statement to correct you, Gordon. I'm not arguing at all.
Okay, fine.
Okay, right up here.
Just following up on that, whichever you would like to answer, which would you prefer, picking up the unusual rock or a representative rock?
Both. We want our cake and to have our cake and eat it too, like everybody else.
I think part of this is being helped by from Apollo 14 on, there's the so-called comprehensive sample in which the astronaut
takes a given area and picks up all the rocks of about walnut size, and so therefore you can see what's representative and you can see the unusual rocks there. This takes the human element out of it quite a bit. Yes.
We should mention, though, that the size of the sample is different for lunar finds than for the coarse rocks. A milligram of the finds, the lunar finds, could have given us much of the information that was obtained on lunar finds with a much larger sample. That's a milligram. It would be a hell of a difficult job to get it, but you could.
Evelyn?
I'm extremely puzzled by some of the things that you all are saying, because I very distinctly remember when the guys were on the surface talking about purple rocks and funny-looking rocks, and I was very much under the impression that they were looking for unusual rocks, and on both flights, as a matter of fact.
Correct.
We are talking about the kind of intuition. Let me first state backgrounds here. I'm sitting in a panel with three geologists, and I'm a chemist. I call myself a geochemist, okay? So maybe I have more respect for these gentlemen than they deserve.
You've never shown it in the past, Gordon.
I've shown respect, but maybe not more than you deserve, Ralph. At any rate, my feeling is that there is a kind of depth of perception of relationships and a kind of intuition that geologists have because of their background and training that even chemists are not likely to have, as I know to my sorrow, because I'm trying to learn it, and at my advanced age it's damn tough to learn, and that people who are astronauts, with the single exception of Jack Schmidt, who's a geologist, are not likely to have either, despite the fact that they have been going through a rigorous and well-planned and comprehensive period of training. They have so many other things to learn, they just can't learn this all that well either. Now, maybe some of my geological colleagues would like to disagree with me. I would find it peculiar that they would like to disagree with me, but I give them that opportunity. Silence speaks for itself.
Question over here.
Do any of you see any particular advantage in holographic photography of lunar surface material in that it could be shown in three-dimensional form before it's ever touched by any instrument and so forth?
Can the hardware be transported at this stage?
Robin? Can the hardware be transported at this stage for lunar photography?
I would say no. I think that would be difficult. The problem of setting up to take a hologram is elaborate. And I think it would probably be far too big a payload to take to the moon at this stage. Eventually, I can imagine people will have brownie holograms, brownie type of holograms, but not now.
Would it be advantageous?
Sure. It's a tremendous amount of data in a very small piece of film.
Article.
I guess I'll throw this one open to anybody that wants to answer. Considering what's already happened with the Viking program, can any of you all be optimistic that Congress will be more willing, you think, to support unmanned missions anywhere than they have been in the past versus manned?
I guess that's my hot potato. I wasn't trying to speak to the politics of getting the money, and I think your objection is both understated and valid. I think it is unlikely that Congress would be willing to support a large program of unmanned missions. I was speaking as a scientist concerned with the rational construction of a rational program. My impression of it, some of my political scientific colleagues claim it is otherwise, but my impression of it is that politics is not a rational thing. And that, therefore, if one is trying to speak only in a rational way, one leaves the politics out of it. That isn't fair, I grant you that. But if we have any way of conveying to the people of this country, on whose opinions the actions of Congress in some ultimate way depend, that this is an important and exciting program of scientific exploration, if we can convey that and really get it across to the intensity that I think the idea deserves, then I think we could equally well convey that the most efficient way to do it from a rational point of view At least it ought to be considered whether the most efficient way to do it from a rational point of view is not doing it with unmanned probes, to some extent at least. Now, I'm not talking about forever and ever. I hope I see the day when there's a thriving scientific laboratory permanently based on the moon. Robin's patent should help. I hope I see the day when a man lands on Mars. I hope I live long enough. I equally hope that I do not see a crash program begun to do that within the next decade or so, because I think that would be a terrible waste of national resources. But it seems to me that we have a very difficult educational problem here. We have to convey something of the importance of what we're doing, which is technically very complicated and therefore very difficult to convey. And at the same time, we have to be conservative of national resources, which are not obviously not infinite. And I don't have a simple and easy recipe for going between Scylla and Charybdis here, but I do raise the problem. I think that in rational terms, one can make an argument that the best way to explore the moon might well be by unmanned probes, and then the question is whether you can do it that way, whether you can only do it if you carry on with a manned program because of political considerations, whether you can do it at all. I think there is no question but that it is worth doing.
Other questions?
Might you suggest, the unmanned program for the more hazardous areas?
Right, yes. And certainly for distant planets. The first explorations of Mars, granted that the program goes that far, you know, we aren't just cut off at the knees, should clearly be by well-instrumented unmanned probes. The more hazardous areas, quite correct again. If we can build unmanned probes that will get us back significant quantities of samples with information on where they came from and what they looked like on the surface, and do this fairly cheaply, we ought to put as many of them on the lunar surface as we can. We have this terrible sampling problem. Maybe the Russians will do it. And if they do, I hope they share their data with us.
Ed DeLong?
Perhaps Dr. Gold would like to answer this one, and then maybe anyone else who'd like to comment. We can see the end of Apollo here pretty close. You've got a finite amount of material that'll be coming back from it, assuming successful landings. Has the time come now to start planning a definite unmanned program of landings, or maybe should we have a break for a while, take a look at what we've learned? Sonnet said a couple of days ago that it'll take years to figure out what we've got here, and then plan a new approach of whatever.
I'm not NASA administrator. You're asking. You want opinions?
Yeah. I'm asking for a scientific statement.
Yes, you're asking for my opinion, but I just want to. This is an uninformed opinion. Okay. I think it is. In this sense, it's not uninformed. I think it is trivially obvious that we have enough to do with what we have from 11 and 12, just re-examining samples from 11 and 12 in the light of what we've already learned from them to keep us busy for several years to come on very productive work. And presumably 14, 15, 16, and 17 will just add to that. So it's true that there's a great deal of very good science that we can do with the material that we can envision getting from the Apollo program. We could all keep ourselves busy for a decade after that thing ended if nothing more came back. That, I think, is not a very good idea. My gut feeling is it would be better to keep the momentum going, because a great deal of the really exciting ideas that come out of these things we probably already have seen. It's a cream-skimming process. And you do tend to see the really exciting things in the first pass. Then you go back later and you pick up the smaller details and try to make the models more comprehensive and more consistent. And this is good science, and it's very well worth doing. But I think it would be wise to continue it. Now, in what form it should be continued, whether it will be continued at all, I really cannot say much about that. I can express my opinions, and I have. What it depends on is something far beyond these considerations.
Any of your other gentlemen care to say anything on that?
I feel sort of the same way as Gordon. I'm in the lunar rock business. The more rocks we can look at, the happier we are. In answer to whether we should delay, I think, yes, there are data that you can work up and will take years and years to find out, but many of these things are second-order things. The business of choosing a landing site, why this site is different to another site, why we should go here and not go there,
is a fairly simple process which you can decide on the basis of almost the preliminary examination. These rocks are obviously different to those ones. This site is just like the one that we've been to, the one that a possible plan one. Therefore, we can go to some other site instead. I think that you could have this continuing missions to the moon, bringing back rocks and getting the first cut, the prime information out, and the other stuff coming out slowly over a period of time.
Other questions? Thank you very much.